Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. Coming up over the next half hour, preventing tragedy, dealing with the trauma, and demanding safer schools after a deadly series of shootings in the U.S. And No Man is an Island, the legacy of Bishop Pierre Claverie, 10 years after his murder in Algeria, building friendship between Christians and Muslims. Hello, everyone. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. A spate of deadly shootings at U.S. schools, three in just 1 week, has raised fresh questions about what causes such attacks. On Monday, a gunman attacked an Amish school in rural Pennsylvania, killing five girls and critically wounding five others before he committed suicide. Last week, an armed 15-year-old at a Wisconsin school killed the school's principal. And in Colorado, a man took six high school girls hostage, fatally wounding one, and then killed himself. School shootings have prompted changes to school safety rules, sparked debate over the availability of guns, and prompted a series of academic studies on what causes people, particularly young people, to commit such violent acts. Bishop Kevin Rhodes heads the Diocese of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where the Amish school shooting occurred. He told Susie Hodges how he reacted to this spate of shootings.
It really is a terrible tragedy. Innocent children who are victims of such violence in our society, that even our schools, our schoolhouses, are not safe from the plague of violence. I think particularly of the Amish community in Lancaster County. We have many brothers and sisters in the Amish community, and it's a very peaceful community, very deeply rooted in the Christian faith, very nonviolent religious practice, and this is especially devastating to that community.
Now, whenever we get incidents like this, there's always a lot of, shall we say, soul-searching about the issue of gun control, the easy access to guns. Is there a definite gun culture, do you feel, not just in your diocese, but to a large extent throughout the U.S.?
In my own diocese of Harrisburg, certainly we see violence in our cities at times. It's not as prevalent as in some of the larger cities of the United States, but it is definitely a problem. This incident that happened in Lancaster County was in a rural area, very peaceful country, and it just is something that people would not expect. I mean, it came as a shock to all of us, and, you know, definitely gun control is an important issue that needs to be looked at. The specifics of this case is still being investigated about the access to the weapons that the shooter had in the Lancaster County. Whether he obtained the guns legally or not is a question, but he had quite an arsenal from what I understand. So it is a difficult problem in society in the United States.
And what do people feel, what more can be done to try to prevent such incidents happening? You know, try to go to the root causes, if you like.
Well, I think, you know, it gets back to what Pope John Paul II used to call the culture of death. And we see this in many ways manifest in incidents like this. To think that our schools are not safe places for our children at times is a pretty scary thought. Certainly one of the things that we need to do is make sure that we provide the adequate and necessary security in all of our schools. This is something that perhaps wouldn't have been thought of years ago. Schools were not places that people expected this kind of violence. But after Columbine, we've seen various school shootings. And if you look at this schoolhouse in Lancaster County, the Amish schoolhouse, they would not even have thought about that kind of security. It's such a peaceful rural area. So I think, at least as a short term, we have to make sure that our schools are secure. But as you mentioned, the deeper causes have to do with fighting a culture of violence. What leads people to such desperate acts?
Some psychologists are saying that sometimes the reasons for this might grow out of what they call a patriarchal society that nourishes unhealthy notions of manhood, notions that in turn foster a culture of violence among many males. Do you think there could be some truth to that?
Perhaps. I really don't know. I think the problem needs to be studied in depth. I think in some situations, and perhaps the one here in my own diocese, if there were some, very possibly, some serious mental problems of this man, then you get back to the idea of someone who really was able to have access to buying guns. Part of the problem is, you know, there is pretty easy access to guns in this country.
And do many people feel, or do you feel, that this gun culture, this culture of violence, is perhaps becoming more prevalent?
I think certainly in relation to schools, you know, crime statistics, and depending on which crimes we're talking about, crimes with guns, I think nationwide, and there's been some decline in recent years, but then it varies, you know, then there's a spike in crime again. And it also depends on the area of the country and particular cities and what kinds of things they're doing in particular cities to curb violence. So some places they've been more successful, and there have been a decline in crime rate, especially with guns. Other areas, there's been a growth. I think we all just have to analyze and examine and study this, and also, you know, take action to protect our young people.
And that was Bishop Kevin Rhodes of the Diocese of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, speaking to my colleague Susie Hodges. Well, while demands for greater school safety are certainly among the first reactions to any school shooting, the trauma for families and whole communities can run deep and last years. Charles Collins spoke with psychotherapist Jan Switzer after her own mountain community in Colorado reeled in shock after last week's school shooting there. For most, it brought back memories of another dramatic and deadly shooting that seemed to have set the precedent for such attacks in the U.S.
You automatically go back to the April 21st, 1999 situation with Columbine, where, you know, that takeover, and it automatically triggers back to, oh my God, here we go again, another awful situation. Our kids are not safe. I think it also triggers a lot of other traumas that people have experienced in the past.
What common problems can happen after an event like this?
Well, one of the things that, first, there's denial that they can handle it. The initial reaction is usually just the shock. The kids are in shock. The teachers are in shock. Everyone in the community actually is in shock. The first thing that they want to do is be with their families and be safe with them. The next thing that might be expected is that one of the things that happens in trauma situations is that you become more fearful. You become more fearful of your surroundings. You have a sense that you don't want to leave the home. You have a sense that you're not as safe as you used to be. And things like firecrackers and things like that are going to trigger you. Anything that has a sound like a gun is going to trigger you. Anyone that you don't know that looks suspicious, you're going to be more questionable about who they are. You know, you may react more strongly than you would normally have.
How does this affect the community in a school when an event like this happens?
Everybody becomes much more closer together. You know, there's probably more openness as far as talking. And within the community itself, you know, people are more apt to be connected with one another just because it's a common tragedy that happens to all of us. They want to be more connected to one another. You may see services in your churches, the population of people coming to church rising as a result of this. People are going to still question, why did this happen? Why did this happen? And they're going to look for answers, you know, and they may go to the church for that. They may go to therapy for that. They're definitely going to you know, question, why did this have to happen? And I think that the and another thing too, I think that the schools have to look at what kind of safety measures they need to be taking. Do we need to be more of a lockdown school overall, where you have to have metal detectors when you come in the door and things like that? I think all of that takes place. And I think, you know, and there's going to be a lot of anger, too. I would ask for continued prayers throughout from everyone for healing and understanding. And also forgiveness is really important, even to the shooter. As horrible as it happened, you know, that just so that there's some healing that takes place, but prayers definitely are needed. Always can use that.
Jan Switzer, a psychotherapist from Conifer, Colorado. Years ago this year, Bishop Pierre Claverie of Oran was killed by Islamic militants in Algeria. His death came amidst a turbulent moment in the country's history when Islamists poised to win elections failed to gain power. Journalists, teachers, critics, and Christians, including seven Trappist monks, were among the 150,000 people who died in the widespread violence. Fellow Dominican, Father Jean-Jacques Perenet, is the author of a best-selling biography about Bishop Claverie. He spoke to me about his friend's legacy in interfaith friendship and the lessons it can give us at a time of globally strained relations between Christians and Muslims.
I have had the chance of living with him in Algeria before he was a bishop. As a Dominican, we share the same community life in Algiers. And then when he became bishop, I found that he was a great inspiration for my own work, you know, in the area of interreligious dialogue. This is why when he died, I felt important to explain the message of his life, of his given life.
How many years then did you know him?
Well, we met each other maybe in 30 years ago. Mm. So he died 10 years ago, so at least during 20 years, he ordained me priest, for example, and we are good friends, yes. Mm.
And you wanted to publish this book on the anniversary of his death?
The book was published already a few years ago, but now, at the 10th anniversary of his death, I'm very impressed to see that it seems that his message is still very relevant for our days. In Algeria, for example, in Oran, where he was a bishop, we had a little meeting in a little congress, let us say symposium, in June. And we have been very surprised to see many Muslims coming to attend this congress. Mm. We have been for 2 days more than 400 people, and maybe 250 were Muslims. Mm. So it's very interesting to see that 10 years of his death, after the death of the Catholic bishop, this means still something for people then there in Algeria. Mm.
Before we get into his life, let's talk about how he died.
You know, Algeria went through 10 years very hard, you know, in the 90s, when the Islamists tried to impose in Algeria an Islamic regime. And they started to kill everyone who would represent an open country. For example, they killed many women who used to speak and to work. And they killed many journalists, intellectuals. And they killed as well some religious Catholic who was a symbol of the possibility of having an Algeria which is not only Muslim. And this is why I think he was killed, because he was somebody who spoke very strongly as well against this idea of having a closed country.
And this was back in the 1990s, which was also a period where we saw the killing of seven Trappist monks.
Exactly. They were killed the same year. Pierre was killed in August, and the monks were killed in May, 1996.
So how did the bishop react to the killing of the monks? Because he was obviously there in the country at the time. Was he concerned for his own life?
Yes, he was certainly concerned for his own life. And when I met him, I found him very, you know, a bit worried. But I think he was more concerned for the situation of his country. Because like many Algerians, he didn't want a country which would reject everything which is different. And he was very sad for the death of the monks, because the monks, you know, were very simple people living in the country, praying. They were not involved like he was in official statement, public statement. And for him, and for, as for, as well for many Muslims, you know, Algerian Muslims, killing these monks has really been a shame, you know. And many, I know many Muslims who are very ashamed by that.
Tell me, Bishop Claveret was an Algerian European.
Yes.
And he, what did, he grew up part of his life in Europe and part of his life there
in
Algeria?
No, he was born in Algeria in 1938 and lived most of his life, except 8 or 9 years of studies abroad. Huh? Mm. But what is interesting is that he grew up, as many Europeans in Algeria, without meeting what he called later the other.
Mm.
He was like, you know, like often we are in little groups, you know, on like a club, you know, and the Europeans were together, the Muslims were in another part of the city.
Mm.
And it is only at the age of 20, when he became a religious, that he opened his eyes and discovered that the world was more different and more interesting as well.
Mm.
And so this became as like a challenge for his life, really. He started to learn Arabic, which he didn't know. And then he started to understand what is Islam. He started to make friendship with many Muslims. And for him, friendship became a key, very important, to open the hearts and to make possible the relationships. And then he was involved in the work of the church in Algeria. As you know, there are very few local Christians. But the church tried to be a witness of the gospel just by sharing the life of the people, helping those who are in need, and welcoming everyone. So he worked in the church and then became a bishop in 81 for 15 years before he died.
And he was in Oran. What kind of city was that?
Oran is one of the second or the third city of the country, in the north of the near the Mediterranean Sea, near Morocco as well, the Moroccan border. It's a quite nice city with very few Christians, but Pierre was able to develop a lot of relationships with the people in Oran. It was very amazing to see this year, 10 years back afterwards, that still many, many people of the city remember his presence and his message. Mm.
I read also in some notes on your biography there of him that his funeral was full and mostly even of more of Muslims than Christians.
Exactly. And the Muslims were crying as much as we are crying, you know. It was very moving to see that his death had really a strong sense for all of us, you know, not only for the Christians. And some friends, Algerian Muslims, told us he was not only your bishop, he was our bishop.
Mm.
Which is very moving, because they are Muslims and they want to remain Muslim, I mean. And Pierre was very clear on that. He said, I'm not here to try to pick few guys like that and bring them to the church.
Mm.
We are all looking together, walking towards God, and let us do it as well as we can and together.
You know, I may be wrong, but I don't remember hearing of any other assassinations or murders of Christian religious following his death.
Exactly, he was the last one. He used to say in the last years, every morning I start my day by praying and asking God, there will nobody will be killed today. And the friend who collected his this from him said maybe he would add, and if somebody has to be, I should be the last one. But he has been the last one, really.
And Bishop Claveret, his vision of a new world, let's say, of relations between people of different cultures, different faiths, was all, it sounds to me, based on becoming friends.
Yes.
Getting to know your neighbor.
Friendship, and as well being convinced that, as Lumen Gentium said, the spirits of God, the Holy Spirit, speaks everywhere out of the border of the visible borders of the church. And I think Pierre was, in that sense, quite original in his vision of the interreligious dialogue. As you know, after Vatican II and Nostra Aetate, We have developed in the church lots of important meetings, councils, things like that, to promote the dialogue. And I think this has been important. But Pierre used to say, often we use empty words. For example, we say, oh, we are all the sons of Abraham. Yes, but we keep fighting. So he used to say, we don't have yet the words, the real words for dialogue. Let us start by addressing together the common challenges of the world, justice, reconciliation, and then we build friendship and we build relationships, and afterwards maybe we can progress in the field of interreligious dialogue. He had a quite personal vision and approach of this issue.
And how did he actually put that into action, into words himself?
You know, when the French had to leave Algeria in 62, the churches became empty.
But why? Because they were filled with French?
The Christians were French. The French left, so there are no more Christians in the country, very few ones. But Pierre said, let us use these places to do things together. So he opened the doors of his church in some ways and his everything they had to develop these places for working together on reconciliation.
But they weren't just talk shops inside
the
churches.
No, not talks. No, for example, you know, in the third world country, often in a family there are 8-10 children, they have no space to study. So let us give them just a hall, a reading hall. We provide books if it's needed, even without books, but a hall, silence, chairs, tables. It's very simple. But it offers something people need, you know. Promotion of women as well. For example, women, as you know, in the Muslim countries, often live at home, but they need some education, they need to get some skills, you know, and the church can help to give them that. So they used to do that.
He used to invite them in.
Yes. And not only him. I mean, it's a policy of the whole church in Algeria till now.
Mm-hmm. How much was this aimed at becoming friends and how much was aimed at evangelizing and trying to encourage people to turn to Christianity?
You know, the past of the relationships between Christian and Muslim is so difficult that it's very difficult till now to speak of a real mission of evangelization, because the Muslim world is very afraid of proselytism. They feel we first have to respect them for what they are. So Pierre used to say, we don't want to proselyte. We want first to be with you witnesses of God's love. And there is a lot to do, you know, just to be witnesses of God's love. And for example, sharing the daily life, remaining in the country when it was dangerous to be there. This has been a great, great sign of love of the people and of the country, you know. And I see that 10 years afterwards that the people didn't forget that, you know. A Muslim scholar from the university said, well, you have been with us in the hard times. Dear brothers and sisters, be sure that this is your country. It was beautiful to hear that from a Muslim, you know, because, as you know, there are other people today who want to get rid of everything which is different, which is not Muslim, which is not, you know.
What would the bishop say today if he were here, seeing the tensions between, in a way, between the West and the East?
Yes, he used to say, I think he would say what he said already, let us be conscious of the heaviness of the past.
What do you mean by heaviness?
You know, we had the Crusades, we had all these things, you know, the Muslims invading other countries, coming to Vienna, all the tensions, violence. Let us be conscious of that and let us try to heal the wounded memory of people and countries and on human groups, you know. There's a lot to do in the area of healing the memory. This is why we have tried to use this 10th anniversary of his death to address this issue of healing. The violence now is more or less over in Algeria, but 150,000 people have been killed. And many women don't know till now who has killed their husband, their son, their daughter. People want to know. You heard of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa.
Yes.
You know what's going on in Rwanda, you know. Mm-hmm. We see that now in Iraq, in Kosovo. You know, there is a deep need in our world of healing process. And I think
it's one thing, though, to talk about a healing process in a way at a political and social level in Algeria, and another thing altogether to talk about a healing process between Christians and Muslims and Jews over the Crusades and over the Islamic invasion of Europe.
But I think we have to dare to address this difficult issue as well, you know. Let us sit together, let us do things together. We can build, you know, real friendships and relationships together.
But how do you do that?
Just being there. Just being there. Often people tell us, oh, are you not afraid? We don't have to be afraid. Maybe there are some risks sometimes, but, you know, this is the gospel as well, you know. We have to share life with people. And there is a lot of joy, you know, just to be there with people, to enjoy their happiness, to suffer when they are sad, you know, just to be with them. And then you enter in a better knowledge, and you see that in their religion they have good things, and they see that in our religion we have good things as well.
How do people like me, like my family, like you know, anybody who's living a life with a family and work and so on, how do we translate your missionary work into our own personal lives?
Yes, I know that it's maybe more difficult for you living here in Europe or in the States. But often I see that we are afraid to meet the other, you know. Or say, oh, there are many Arabs in the country, there are many Muslims, but do you know one of them? Start by one. Or do something with one or two of them, and you will discover that there is, maybe it will be fun, it will be nice, you know, to do something together. Maybe you will not achieve a great thing, but let us try. I think it's amazing to see that in our world of globalization, we are closing ourselves in little islands, little groups, identity groups, you know. It is very strange, maybe because people are afraid of losing their identity. And so all these migrants coming, I'm not saying it's an easy issue. I mean, we need policies in this, and I'm not saying it's not a problem. In the suburbs, in Europe, all that, I know it's very difficult. But if nobody tries to build some bridges, we are going to have a disaster. We have it already. So we need to build bridges.
And a very warm thanks there to Father Jean-Jacques Perrenet, the author of a best-selling biography about Bishop Claveri. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
Listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.